Do we really know where we are? We're going to have a sky breaking today, and we're going to find out what that is. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Our telephone number to talk about wayfinding today is 1-800-478-8255 statewide, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Yeah, a skybreaking at the FedEx hangar this afternoon with all sorts of dignitaries present to talk about mapping. We'll find out more on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Pacific University is still accepting applications for the fall 2015 semester for their Master of Business Administration program. APU offers personalized education grounded in hands-on, real-world experiences to prepare graduates to be leaders in their communities. More at 1-800-ALASKA-U or alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, this is one of those great uses of Talk of Alaska because we're doing geography on the radio, and this is an event that's going to happen in Anchorage, but really probably has more important implications for people all over the state of Alaska. And so we're on statewide radio to talk about it, and your questions and comments are welcome. I don't think there's anybody who flies in Alaska who hasn't been in an unfortunate situation of going into a cloud bank and hoping that they know where they are. And our maps are not always accurate. There's a sky-breaking ceremony today which will commemorate, will mark a landmark of Alaska, more than half of Alaska being accurately mapped. You know, I thought we had maps of the whole state. I guess we do, but I guess they're just kind of off. But they're less off than they used to be. And there's three people here, very highly qualified panel. And if you're watching the cable transmission of this program, you get to see everybody's wearing their ties and all because there's a big ceremony. Everybody's bosses and so forth, agency people, are in town for this. So this is a big deal. And yet it's about something that is so laden with alphabet soup and technical terminology that it defies easy explanation. But we'll do our best. So I think I'm going to start with Nick. Maestro de Casa, is that right?
Very good.
And you're with the state Department of Transportation. Why would they be all that interested in roads? I mean, obviously they're interested in roads, but why would they be so interested in maps at the Transportation Department?
Well, I'll turn that around on you, and I would say, why wouldn't every Department of State be interested in accurate mapping? It's used by everybody, and it's important to everybody for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking, you know, one thing is fairly obvious. If you have a construction project, you've got to do a survey, and you've got to find your corners. And that, I watch these people do this. This seems to be a little more difficult in Alaska than it is in other places, to just get basic cadastral survey.
It is. And when you're talking about building roads or infrastructure, you really want to know where the water is going to flow. It tells you where you're going to put your culverts. Otherwise, you're just going to build a road and it's going to wash out. And that's not good for taxpayer dollars. It's just not.
Well, as most Alaskans know, much of the land in Alaska is federal, and we have two people with the federal government with us. And it really is federal resources that are being used largely to fund this mapping effort. So let's start with Kevin Gallagher of the USGS. How you doing, Kevin?
I'm great. Thanks. And thanks for allowing me to be on your program today.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. This kind of show is bread and butter for me, and I think for a lot of Alaskans, because they love hands-on stuff, they like technical stuff, and they like knowing how things really work. And this mapping is one area, I think, where technology has, you know, I mean, there's gray hair in this room. You know, we've been through how many generations of maps here in our lives?
Well, that's a really good point. The U.S. Geological Survey, I don't know how well your listeners know us or our mission. It's really quite broad, but the survey aspect really goes back to the 1800s, where I think the early leaders of this country really recognized that the expansion of the West, the economy, the basic development of the fabric of the society was needed to be built upon detailed surveys. And so some of our earliest expeditions out west were all about understanding elevation, understanding hydrology, hydrography. Those are the things that we've been about since our inception in 1879.
Well, I think most people who hike come across these odd brass or bronze things that are kind of stuck in a rock somewhere.
Yeah, benchmarks.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. That were put there by the USGS. It says right there. That's says it's your property, as a matter of fact.
It does, yeah.
and I think when I was reading through the briefing materials for this project, I discovered that they're not necessarily accurate, these things.
Well, you mentioned the multiple technologies, and certainly when we started, all of our mapping was done with manual techniques and cartography. And while it was state-of-the-art of its time, we all, I think, can recognize how far technology has come. And what we're doing today is accurate within millimeters and centimeters. That kind of accuracy is pretty amazing, and it allows us to be much more accurate with everything from civil engineering to flood prediction to even understanding forest canopies, which we can do now with some of the detailed LIDAR we're getting through what we call our three-dimensional elevation program. And IFSAR here in the state of Alaska.
IFSAR?
Yes. IFSAR is Interferometric Synthetic Aperture Radar. It's a technology that's
good Lord.
You wanted to go to tech.
Yeah. Well, maybe went too quickly to some of the tech, but it's essentially a radar, but it by projecting it at the ground and measuring the reflectance back, gives you a very highly detailed elevation map. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah, well put. Yeah, actually, I am I'm really familiar with this AR because I was there when the first CSAT data was revealed, which was Chris McCandless's dad was in charge of, by the way. And he said, well, it's beautiful, but we don't really know what it means. And it was the first satellite, pretty much, that was put up and proved that you could do active sensing as opposed to just the light that's coming off the earth. You could send a signal to the earth and then get it back. He said, but we don't know what it means. It's at frequencies that we haven't ground truthed yet to know what they are. Well, you know, that was 1979. So I assume we've made some progress in this. I think we'll turn now to Chris Noyles of the Bureau of Land Management, the Civil Applications Committee. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about what this SAR does. I know that Kevin is kind of a science guy here, but still.
Well, excuse me.
Well,
that's a Ronald
Reagan
tall order.
Said, huh?
Yeah, that's a tall order there.
That's
as
why
Kevin
it was
said,
given to you.
As Kevin said, it's an active sensor, and so you do get that return from the ground and back, and so that allows us to do a number of different things. This particular sensor allows us to pull out a digital terrain model and a digital surface model, and there's two different things that are very important about that. Is one is the top of obstructions or trees or buildings, and the other is the bare earth, and we need both of those to accurately map Alaska and to use it for its fullest extent. The technology also provides for an orthorectified radar image, which is very significant because it ties everything in its proper place on the ground. That's where you really start getting into the technical stuff when you look at the ORI. And you were mentioning the CSAT and how technical that is. And SAR is a science into itself, and you have to start understanding foreshadowing and layover and other technical terms that, you know, you spend a long time getting up to speed on and looking at things that are kind of in a grayscale and what does speckle mean and how does that affect what you're looking at? And am I penetrating canopy or am I hitting the ground completely or am I penetrating through ice? There's a lot of details there.
Absolutely fascinating. And so how does somebody gets to look at this, but who gets to use it?
Well, I think everybody gets to use it. One of the benefits.
Well, I know, for instance, that the oil exploration is very important for. They can tell a lot about the ice now from just this synthetic aperture radar imagery, and they actually pay for more sensing than is just provided through the public facilities because they need it. Mm-hmm. But I understand that part. And then I heard about hydrology, you know, where the water is going to go. That would be a good thing to know. Let's try a few more.
Well, if you don't mind on the hydrology, one of the things that we found early on the North Slope, and I was mentioning this to you earlier, is, you know, if you look at the North Slope, it's very flat, very just a little bit of undulation. And so if you're standing there, you're looking at water and you're thinking it's going that direction. But when you look at the IFSAR, and you start pulling out the detail, you find that water bodies that you think are flowing in one direction are actually flowing in another direction, which when you start modeling things, you start to understand that maybe we need to change our watershed boundaries because what we thought was part of this watershed is actually part of the neighboring watershed.
Mm.
And so, you know, you want water going in the right directions, and this helps us define that, as Nick had mentioned earlier.
So we have management issues.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we also have predictive issues. The tundra is warming, and as it warms, it starts to percolate, and the water is going to seep through the tundra. So where are the water resources of tomorrow going to be?
Mm.
And that's very important to the native cultures that live off the land. So there are it's more than just where water's going, it's also where will water be.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Nick, because I'm continually saying, you know, as valuable as the data is today, and we haven't fully talked about all the applications yet. There are many more we could discuss here.
I think we'll never get there, actually.
We may not get there today. But it's going to be that much more valuable 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now, because the data we're collecting now is going to serve as a baseline to understand the changes that are occurring out on the landscape. So there's, you know, our motto at USGS is science for a changing world. The world is always changing. Many of us in the science community believe it's being accelerated now through global change. What we're seeing in Alaska is glacier retreat. We're seeing permafrost melt. We're seeing shoreline erosion. So to be able to capture this detailed elevation today is going to be incredibly valuable, say, 10 years from now, to compare this data to, and then try to understand what's happening with those processes. As Chris mentioned, maybe the hydrology is going to change. Maybe water's going to flow in a different direction. Maybe the land's going to subside. All of this has serious implications for infrastructure, like transportation, pipeline routing, oil and mineral exploration, resource management, wide implications for Alaskans.
Okay, let's say I'm a pilot, and I'm flying VFR, and I go into the clouds, and I'm in a place that it's instrument conditions, and I can't see.
Well, let me give you an example that was written up in the Washington Post here just about a year ago. There was a flight that was going through Mystic Pass. It was a Beaver followed by a 206. They went through Mystic Pass. The weather descended on them. The Beaver couldn't see, and the Mystic Pass was too narrow for him to turn around. If you had synthetic vision, which would be largely in part due to IFSAR, he could have been flying GPS with synthetic vision and actually see on a tablet the terrain below him and in front of him, and he could have gone through the pass. As it is, he was probably, it's assumed he was flying a GPS route as best he could, but he crashed 600 feet below the ridge line, and it killed two people. And it's not the only instance of something like that happening. So, but if you had a rolling map that was accurate based on IFSAR in the cockpit, we could avoid those accidents. Now, some people say, well, you're just encouraging people to fly in really bad conditions when you do that, and that's not the intent. It's not the intent. I mean, you can't fix stupid.
No, but it's it is a growing problem. I mean, people are using GPS and thinking they know where they are.
Yeah,
trusting the machinery more than the old time pilots. You know, they had all sorts of cues they could use.
Steve Colligan from ITERA always says, "You've got these devices, and it's gospel, you know, gospel out of the device when it's not. The information could kill you. In Alaska, it can kill you."
Yeah. But what kills me is that the GPS might not even be accurate.
Well, I think the GPS.
I mean, what are we celebrating now? Getting down to 5 meter resolution. So it's worse than 5 meters off now in a lot of the state.
there are some ridge lines we've seen that are close to 1,000 meters off.
It's not
as bad as we originally thought, but it's bad.
Wow.
So we are seeing valleys that are horizontally displaced by half a mile.
Have to understand that some of the data is 40, 50, or 60 years old, and the technologies that were used. Alaska, as you know, very difficult terrain, a third of the landmass of the lower 48, very difficult to work in even today. We give a lot of credit to our partners in private industry. They're actually the ones we're contracting with the private sector to acquire all this data. So they're the ones staging the aircraft, making the surveys. What an incredible effort it is even today with modern technology. So it's hard to fault those in the past that did the best they could with the technology they had. But
no,
that's the data that we're working with today.
Well, I think you hit the key. Alaska's a big state.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big state. And when it comes to remoteness, we got plenty of it.
It is, and people said when we started this, we'll never finish it because it is so big and it would be so costly.
Uh-huh.
But we're really very, very close, within, you know, a hair's breadth of being 60% complete with the state.
Wow.
And I want to go back to something that was stated in the beginning. It wasn't necessarily accurate that the feds are footing the bill for this all by themselves. Sorry, Chris, but the state has put $12 million into it already.
Well, yes, if I could expand on that just very quickly. We're so proud and pleased with this partnership that we have because it's much more than the feds and the state. There's been a tremendous amount of leadership in the Department of Interior. Jennifer Gimbel, our Assistant Secretary for Water and Science, and my director, Suzette Kimball, have provided tremendous leadership. But we have a federal executive mapping committee. So that includes NOAA, NASA, Department of Agriculture, the other bureaus within the Department of Interior, FEMA. We have a great partnership with the state. Nick has been a tremendous leader in the state for a decade on this mapping issue. The state legislature, the governor's office, the Department of Natural Resources in the state have all been significant partners. And as I mentioned, the private industry. And so it really takes a village in this case, and we're all pulling the oars in the same direction to achieve this goal.
Yeah, I'm glad you cleared that up. I didn't mean to be unfair on that at all.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things, you know, if I was just to, you know, give a synopsis of the beauty of this project is the collaboration between the parties. It's always pointed to as the project for collaboration and the working capabilities between the state and federal government and agencies.
Yeah, I want to echo that too. A couple of years ago, Kevin will remember, we had an executive roundtable teleconference one time, and we were trying to do some talking points for OMB, and OMB had put out this report earlier in the year, and it was, you know, it's been a follow-up report for several years that the U.S. government does a terrible job of collaborating and coordinating. And I pointed out to Kevin and the other execs and said, we got to hammer this. We're getting it right in Alaska, and we have a partnership, and we are collaborative, and we are coordinating, and this is the example that we should be holding up to OMB and saying, this is how it gets done right from the start.
Thank you. You know, I never tire of saying exactly what you were just saying, that there are areas where Alaska is a leader and doesn't even realize it. You know, we're leading because we had no choice, and we don't even realize that we're ahead of everybody. it's definitely worth pointing to. We're talking about mapping, and we have a very qualified panel with us. And your calls are welcome at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. What's happening today is a sky-breaking ceremony. It celebrates an accurate remapping of 57% of Alaska. It's happening at the FedEx hangar, right? FedEx is donating that? Is that what's
going on?
Yes,
that's correct.
And, wow, that's a big building. You're not going to get anywhere near filling it up.
We have, well, Alaskans are notorious for not RSVPing and just showing up. So if anybody's listening, you might want to, you know, stock up on some munchies before you go. Because
it's
we
like
only
catering challenge.
Yeah, I think that's the way it's going to be. But we have something like 225 RSVPs. So that means we could have as many as 450 people showing up.
What it means to me is that this is a big deal to a lot of people.
It is. It is. And a lot of them are very distinguished dignitaries. In fact, Kevin's boss, the director of USGS, is here today as well for the event.
And it's worth celebrating.
I think that's
also very interesting to me. I mean, frankly, you know, 57% doesn't really excite me all that much, but it is exciting.
Well, when you consider the size of the state.
It is very exciting when you think about the fact that just 10 years ago, we weren't anywhere where we're at today in terms of even getting Alaska on the map. We have old maps, as Kevin's pointed out, and Alaska has always been the challenge. We are the last state in the nation to be mapped accurately, and I'm very happy to be part of the team that's getting it done. And it's taken a lot of work and a lot of handshakes and collaboration, and this is a success story, and we're getting there. We're almost done.
Yeah. When we first started,
when you say 57% doesn't sound like almost done.
Well, we've got only 40% left to go. Let's put it that way. So far, we spent $41 million on it, and most of that money came out of, you know, people's hide. In other words, there was no congressional appropriation to just go and map the state of Alaska. People came to the table with their hard cash and put it down on the table to do this. And over the past 5 years, $41 million has gone towards that.
Wow.
Right. So the rate at which we're moving has been accelerating. From a federal perspective, we've had a lot of support in the budget process from Senator Lisa Murkowski, which we very much appreciate. We have partnered, combined our funds with state funds. So contributions have come from Fish and Wildlife Service, Park Service, Forest Service, BLM, USGS, state, and it is adding up. And there's a unique challenge out there in the Aleutians that that we're also going to address. But if you were to look at a map of the state, which I don't think any of us might have one with us here today.
There's one on the website.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And it does show that the areas of concern are mapped.
Yes, very significant coverage as in the highest required areas. And we have an operational program here. We're not going to stop, and we're going to continue, and It would be my desire to see it finish in the next 2 to 3 years.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So they're
we've been saying that since 2010 every year. So
right, yeah,
we're consistent.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I can see beyond ADAC maybe. Maybe wouldn't quite make the deadline. I'm not sure.
Well, I think we've gone from 6% to where we are today in what, 4 years?
Yeah, five.
Five.
Wow. We started in 2010. Okay.
So what does it actually take in terms of an aircraft? I mean, the CSAT, that was way up, you know. But you're talking basically an airplane that flies at, well, I assume, a fairly low elevation?
40,000 feet.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's not that low then.
No.
So it's up above everything.
But the key point of that to remember is, and we haven't talked about it, is when you're talking about flying an aircraft and you look at Alaska weather, if you walked outside today, what would you see? Clouds up there. Well, the active radar doesn't care about the clouds. And let's face it, we have a lot of clouds in Alaska and a lot of regions that you don't see the ground. And this is the only sensor that actually penetrates the clouds and gets us what we need across the whole state from the start.
And so they basically, somebody somewhere has to set up a grid, I would think, a transects, and then somebody's got to fly it.
Yeah. It's a little bit more complicated than that, and especially when you start talking about the logistics of, you know, the color of the money that's coming in, because you got different federal agencies that are landowners that cannot, for example, Chris can't pay for Park Service land to be mapped. So when you start looking at the map of Alaska, it's a very complicated, it looks like a quilt, a very ugly quilt of land ownership or land status.
Yeah.
And thrown in there is state.
And native corporations.
And native corporations. And so you have to, in order to make these flights efficient, they need to be north-south flight lines and long and straight. And so that's a tough calculus. But, you know, it really speaks to the collaboration and the leadership that Kevin has given this project.
Well, I enjoy the attaboys, but I want to introduce one thing, and that is, and I'm seeing this a lot because I cover scientific issues, and they're trying desperately, really, to install a network of reliable data flow on a grid all over the entire Arctic. And it's largely like vessels of opportunity and so forth like that in order to do this. But it turns out that one of the biggest problems is compatibility of data, that everybody is gathering data in a different way, and it doesn't get reconciled. And I think now we're seeing this with, there's not just one kind of GPS you can get. You know, there's all different kinds.
Right, right. So one of the other things I spend a lot of my time on is that actually that data integration issue.
Yeah.
And at USGS, I feel like we've been one of the, although there's no silver bullet, we've been one of the real leaders, I think, in trying to integrate and make our data widely accessible in machine-readable formats that can be shared and interchanged. And maybe one of the things I failed to mention is that all of this data that we're gathering over Alaska, this elevation data and all of the topography data, is being served into the public domain for anyone to access through our system called the National Map. And so that has modern web services that allow application program interfaces to come in and access that data and use it as people want to use it.
Who's going to tell me how to get into the National Map?
All you have to do is Google it. Just actually, if you Google USGS and 3D elevation program, or USGS and the National Map, or USGS and Alaska Mapping, any one of those will lead you to websites with lots of information and instructions on how to access our data.
And then the State Transportation Department has a pretty handy web facility that just outlines this whole project.
That's actually at the DNR. It's the Alaska Geospatial Council's website.
DNR.
And you can just, yeah, it's held up at DNR. And you can find all the links to the National Map there. And also DGGS is serving up all of the elevation data in all its forms, being it the bare earth or the surface model or the ORI, all three of those are there.
Is there still an issue with proprietary data? I mean, like, for instance, mining companies come to mind. You know, prospecting is a delicate matter. Geology is a delicate issue, and you know, it could be huge resources at stake, and some data holder doesn't want to share that data.
Boy, you hit the nail on the head. That is absolutely the case. There's oftentimes a lot of data remotely sensed. It might be gravimetric data. It might be IFSAR, like we're talking about today, or LIDAR. It might be radiometric data, seismic data, and A lot of that's proprietary because, as you pointed out, it gives companies a competitive advantage. And so one of the most important roles I think that we play is that we're talking about acquiring data for the public domain, for access by everybody. And so that's a big aspect, fundamental key to what we're doing.
Can you sometimes get somebody's data because it's old and they don't care anymore?
Yes, that often happens. We have one of the other things I oversee is called the Core Research Center. It's located in Denver, Colorado, and we actually have physical core cuttings of rock core. So in some cases we have cores, some cases cuttings from all over the nation that have been in some cases donated by companies. And then we also have data that might be seismic data or other kinds of data that they've donated. Essentially, it's a library, if you will, for geological researchers.
Our telephone number, once again, 1-800-478-8255. We're having an interesting discussion about the state of the art in mapping in Alaska, and we're just scratching the surface, not to have a pun or anything, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
What do you do with a better map? We've got three people with us today on Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Glad to have you here. Kevin Gallagher is with the USGS Core Science Systems. Chris Noyles is with the Bureau of Land Management. And Nick Mastro de Casa is with the State Transportation Department. And they've all been working together on this mapping project, which is having a sky-breaking today at the FedEx hangar in down by the Anchorage Airport, to celebrate 57% coverage. And as we've heard, that's going to rapidly increase in terms of how much of Alaska is accurately mapped. We've heard already that in some cases they've discovered the mapping is quite inaccurate and has been corrected. I'm thinking about how important this is for aviation. I've kicked it in a couple of times, but maybe we need to really emphasize that, Nick.
Well, I think if you're flying in Alaska, you want to be flying using accurate sectionals, aviation sectionals. And the FAA will eventually upgrade their sectionals based on the IFSAR mapping that's coming out now in the USGS topo. And that's something that we really haven't touched on yet, but USGS is processing new topo maps for Alaska based on the IFSAR as the IFSAR comes in.
Well, I was wondering about that.
It's, yeah, and our topos used to be what, 1 to
1 to 63, 360, which is an inch to the mile, and now we're going down to 1 to 24,000 scale.
Yeah, so it's a higher resolution map with 20-foot contours, and It's like the difference between night and day. It really is.
And then these sectionals, these are these maps that pilots have that are so lavish and beautiful to a layman. And they need updating then.
They will need updating, yes.
Yeah.
But until now, there hasn't been a way to do that. There hasn't been the data to do that. So the sectionals will have a lot more detail to them when they're updated, yes.
Okay, let's go with the calls. Greg joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Greg.
Oh, thank you, Steve, and I want to thank your guest as well, Aloha. And And, you know, I make my living on the water, and where I've come from, I've been up here for 20 years now. We're all watermen, and what you guys are doing and what you're talking about with GPS and climbing through mountain passes when clouds and conditions come in, even when I'm operating the boat on a sunny day, I'm looking at my radar, I'm looking at my depth finder, and I'm looking at my GPS to make sure all three of them match. And my question is, when you guys are doing this geological survey, you know, I'm a waterman, and from what I understand, we're still looking at charts that Captain Cook, and we've got Cook Inlet out here, that Captain Cook, from some of his data that he achieved, you know, centuries ago, we're still relying on some of that. So I really appreciate what you guys are doing. But are you guys looking beneath the surface of the water as well?
Kevin? Well, Nick? Sorry about that.
Okay.
The good news is Senator Lisa Murkowski did plus up NOAA's budget by about $20 million to do some coastal mapping. And included in that, I believe, is some bathymetric work, which would, you know, be underwater mapping. And, you know, Alaska has, 44,000 miles of coastline. So it's going to take a while to get that done. But it is being addressed. And on top of which, NOAA, and I'm going to let Kevin talk about this, has prioritized Alaska for Grav-D. And that's, again, that's, you know, inland, but NOAA's doing a lot of work to, you know, address some of the mapping issues in Alaska.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to point out that NOAA, they have the role for bathymetric mapping around all the coastline of the U.S. My colleague, Juliana Blackwell, at the National Geodetic Survey, she's the director of the NGS, they're leading a major effort to update what's called the datum or the benchmark, if you will, the geoid, so that we can have a solid reference point to understand elevation. She's also leading a coastline mapping effort in Alaska, and I have heard that they're making efforts to accelerate that over Alaska.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the Fennecker kind of woke everybody up because, you know, this thing of fishing vessels were using that route all the time, and all of a sudden, a vessel that draws just a few feet deeper runs into something nobody knew was there. That's kind of a wake-up call. But the mapping that you guys are talking about doesn't actually get down to the seafloor.
The mapping that we're talking about can penetrate small bodies of water. You can see bathymetry along riverbeds, mm-hmm. Certain depths. But no, we cannot get the depth that we need to do a sounding, if you will, at ocean depths. I also maybe just would point out that much of Alaska is part of the Arctic Circle. And with the warming of the Arctic, it's really become a national issue. It's become a strategic issue from not only a defense standpoint, but transportation, fisheries, oil, gas, and mineral exploration. And so there's a tremendous focus, I think, on this administration. And, of course, John Kerry in the State Department is now the chair of the Arctic Council, which is a council of 8 member countries, includes Canada, Russia, Iceland, Norway, etc., looking at some of these issues, and mapping and charting has been identified in the national strategy as a priority.
Greg, you still there?
Yes, I am.
I'm thinking
if we can work with Russia, that would be great because spasiba, and I really appreciate what you guys are doing. And I know that there are some people that want to call Russia our enemies, but I have Russian friends that have fished with me, and it's all important. And to develop partnerships and to be able to get good data so we can help the FAA make Alaska safer for flying and also boating safety is really important. And knowing where the rocks are, we had a vessel that I know of this year that you know, scraped its bottom on a rock or a log, and it was uncharted. So we need to get those things on the chart so we know where the areas to avoid and also know where we can go. And yeah, I want to thank you all very much.
All right, Greg. Yeah, I think it's a matter of priorities, and the priority is going to go to Arctic mapping. They use every opportunity they can right now to map the Arctic seafloor, and I think there is a risk that other areas of the coast might drop lower in the budgetary priority. So it's a good thing to have the delegation keep a close eye on. And I want to thank you for your call. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. We've got Kevin Gallagher at USGS, Nick Mastro de Casa for another couple of minutes with the State Transportation Department, and Chris Noyles of BLM. Well, Nick, we're going to have to let you out of the room here in a few minutes because you've got to greet all these dignitaries that are going to be showing up at the FedEx hangar there.
I do.
But, you know, so I want to give you, you know, some parting words here before you go, because you've really been the lead for this whole project. And it's great you could make the time to come in here.
Well, thank you for having me. I don't feel like I'm the lead for this project. There are a lot of very, very good people working hand in hand to make this come together. But I'm going to leave you with one parting thought. When this whole thing started in 2006, so it's been 10 years almost, I found out that Mars was better mapped, more recently mapped, and more accurately mapped than Alaska. And I'm not saying that to give a dig at anybody, but your caller, Greg, I just want to answer that question by saying this. How do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? And Alaska is a very, very big state, and we are digesting the elephant. Hmm. But with that, I should probably head out and start greeting some people. So forgive me if I leave early.
Yeah, no. Thanks for coming in and being a part of this and helping to explain this. I mean, it really is so technical that it just takes a while to do the exploration, and it's hard to keep an eye on the practicalities of it for your everyday Alaskan. But
well, you have two very good technical people here to answer those questions.
All right. We'll let you go. You can go ahead and step right out the door. We'll be taking a break in just a moment. So what's next? In other words, who flies next where?
We have this Federal Alaska Mapping Executive Committee that includes membership from the state. There's a group of executives that talk about the strategy. In fact, we're having a meeting this week here in Anchorage on Thursday. We'll be talking about what's next. But we have a three-year acquisition plan that we keep intact all the time. So this is kind of delicate. You take a look at the requirements of all the partners in this partnership. Many times the requirements will overlap in a particular cell. And if we haven't mentioned, we've divided Alaska up into these little cells, if you will, these collect cells that are the optimal size in terms of economies of scale to fly. So we're getting the best price, if you will, for the data. And we know then that where those cells are and what land is underneath of it and what are the requirements in that area. And we try, it's kind of like a Rubik's Cube, you know, you're turning all these things to try to get them to line up. But we've had this idealized, if you will, acquisition plan in place that we update. There's a technical team that supports this executive team. That's a darn good group of technical folks that have been working really well together. So we're hopeful that going a cell at a time, we're going to get where we need to get to. Nick mentioned the fact that we're going to be producing topographic maps.
Yeah, that was my next question.
Yeah, if I could touch on that quickly. I guess probably 15 years ago, the USGS transitioned fully from manual techniques to build these topo quads that if anyone's ever been out hiking, they've probably held a quad in their hand. And it's just incredibly important for navigation, recreational purposes, emergency response, etc. And what we're really proud of here in Alaska is that we have modeled our 1 to 25,000 square mile topo after the standard product we do in the lower 48. So today, this is an all-digital product. It's delivered in a GL PDF format to anyone, so you can download it for free off the web, or you can get the raw data out of the national map. It contains elevation, which we've been talking about today, but it also contains hydrography, transportation, structures, boundary, political boundaries, lots of information in this topo, digital topo product. There's about 11,800 roughly needed for the state, and we are producing those as we get the elevation data. So as the elevation data is available, we're producing those out of our...
So it's ongoing. Some are out already.
It is ongoing, and we actually, if that's something you can also find on our website, is a map of where the topo maps are available today and where we're headed with that effort as well. Our NGTOC, our National Geospatial Technical Operations Center in Rolla, Missouri, that's a group of hardworking folks that many of them probably never been to Alaska, but they're doing a fantastic job of producing the topo quads for Alaska.
Oh, yeah, down to the actual quads that you can hold in your hand as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek. It makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
So when I bicycled up to the front of the building this morning, the two gentlemen with me were already standing there, and each of them had a handheld device. And here I just closed the segment saying, well, we get the quad map that you can hold in your hands. Nobody holds those maps anymore. They all got devices.
Well, sometimes they do, particularly like emergency response. But, yeah, why don't you take it, Chris? Because the mobile applications is definitely a big part of our strategy.
Yeah, this is Chris Noyles.
Hi. Well, you know, I think as technology has evolved, we've had to change the way we think. And the paper is great, but it gets wet. And it gets crumbled up and stuffed in the bottom of the backpack. And today, everybody has their phone in their hands. And it doesn't matter where you go, whether you're on the top of a mountain, flat top, or, you know, Balding Eagle River, everybody's got a phone in their hands. They're either taking a picture or they're using it. But at the same time, they could be looking at a map. And you see I have my iPad right here. And this is the national map page right here. And you can see this is where we have coverage.
Wow. Hold it so you probably can get that in.
And as Kevin mentioned, there's all the different categories across the top. I can go to the hydro page. I can go to the imagery page. And, you know, we tile this data up. GS tiles this data up for us, and it sends out in small packages so that you can actually get it on a device. You know, Google Earth came out. And ever since then, we have been on a race to do things better, to get things smaller, quicker, faster, and in the hands of people. And today, there's really, you know, so much you can do with a tablet. Today, we're going to go on a field trip, and I'm going to take my tablet with me. I'm going to have an external GPS that will enhance this signal so I don't have to worry about cell towers. I'm going to take some pictures of Kevin and the other dignitaries, and I'm going to upload that in the field to ArcGIS, and it's going to be populated before we get back to have dinner tonight. And I'm going to slide my tablet across the table, and they're going to see where their trip was and where they were exactly in the pictures, all within the context of a geospatial map.
If the technology works.
I just need
assuming the technology works.
This is so great that you you describe that way, because when you go and look at the state's strategic plan for this mapping project, they say, well, we've also got to make it so people know it's there and use it. But that's all changing with the use of the tablets.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned earlier that our data is available in the public domain. And so a lot of the mobile applications we've been able to build just in partnership with mobile application developers. So, in other words, folks out in private industry that are just interested in the value of our data and being able to serve it through mobile applications. So it's been just a great journey, and it's been fun to be part of.
I'll bet it has, but they still could use more standardization, I think.
I think that'll always be the case.
It would be nice if they formed a trade association or something like that. Like, you know, that's usually how this regulatory process goes. When you get to the self-regulatory stage, everybody says, we really need to do this, people. And then they cooperate.
You mentioned the trade association, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention MAPS. That's an association of photogrammetric professionals that have been incredibly supportive of what we're doing, and they do work together. Even though all the member organizations kind of compete with each other, they do work together on the major issues. They really do a good job of coming together on national issues. So we certainly appreciate their support.
It's Talk of Alaska, and time is running short, but let's get some more calls. Tom joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tom.
Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
We need to consider priorities on projects very carefully, as our very existence on the planet is hanging by a thread. When you consider that a solar flare could take the electrical grid down for years, and we've got 600 nuclear power plants that would go into meltdown. So there's a lot of priorities to look at carefully and make much of the Earth uninhabitable. We need a new political party to tackle these problems that are existing, as our existence. Political parties don't even acknowledge the problem, let alone have any possible solutions to avoid a total disaster.
You know, your caller really brings up a very interesting point. There are so many geological processes affecting our planet. And we actually do have a geomagnetism program at USGS where we monitor solar storms. And that is actually something that is a real possibility, that a solar flare could create some kind of implications for our infrastructure. You know, the good news is that we do have science programs out there that are monitoring that kind of activity. Of course, what to do about it in these days is a huge problem when you consider the size of our society and our infrastructure.
Tom, I want to thank you for your call and your big picture insight there.
Thank you.
All right. It's Talk of Alaska. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And we're talking about mapping and the mapping project that's been going on for Alaska. The maps were 50 years old and not necessarily accurate, in some cases extremely inaccurate, and that is being corrected. It's being corrected, I wanted to say slowly, but it's actually rather fast and increasing. So at 57% at this point, and then thinking to get to completion within a few years, except maybe for a few little outlying little spots here and there. Quite an impressive situation. So many different agencies involved in this. It just, you know, when you start looking at it, it's not even just confined to the Interior Department. You know, not only do you have state and federal and Native Corporation and other private landholders, but then within the federal government, there's NOAA.
Correct. Right.
There's the Forest Service, which is in the Agriculture Department. Mm-hmm. NOAA's in the Commerce Department, the Interior Department. USGS is still in Interior. BLM is still in Interior.
Right.
So I guess we would say that was the main one.
Right. It really is amazing that we've been able to come together this way. It's of course, I think this is good government. This is the way I think government needs to be operated. But we all have our respective missions. We've all recognized that mapping of Alaska is an important priority, and we're working together. So that includes agreements. I mean, can you imagine what's behind this? You know, the contracting, the agreements, the memorandums of understanding, the meetings that coordinate the overall project. It's all there.
Chris, you know, I was thinking, you know, just all my years in talk radio, all the way back to Area 51 and all that stuff. In talk radio, we've been speculating that the military has a massive amount of capacity for remote sensing from space. Is some of this technology, which is probably does exist, making its way through this project back down to, quote, Earth, to where people, real civilians can get at it?
Well, absolutely. I'm a product of the military. My father was in the military, and I spent 22 years in the Air Force myself and in the intelligence world. So I actually have firsthand knowledge of this.
Well, that's why I asked you.
And so, I think sometimes people forget that, in terms of technology and advancement and R&D, a lot of that starts out in the military.
Mm-hmm.
We have a need for that information, and eventually it gets to the point where you've got to recoup some of that investment. And so that's when it becomes privatized and passed out so that it can be used for the greater good. So absolutely, I think if you look at this project and look at the sensors that are being used, and you go back to the early 2000 timeframe, you'll find that the early sensors, the Star 3i, came out of NGA and other agencies, and they had put that on contract to test and demonstrate it, and it's proven successful, and then it's been spun off as a private company, and several different companies actually use the technology now. So, absolutely.
Do you want to step over the line and talk about what the military may have that the civilian sector doesn't?
Absolutely not.
No, I mean, it's purely speculation, but... I've heard this incredible resolution is available now.
I am still waiting to be able to read Titleist on a golf ball.
You mean you haven't? When did you leave the military anyway? It's a beautiful thing. We're really wrapping up the show, and I really congratulate you people because the administrative goat rope of this is very, very challenging. And somebody decided some time ago, well, we really got to be serious about this and get everybody moving and on the same page. And so out of that, we got a council, and we got interagency effort, and we got people that are like just team members, like you're team members, and you know the other team members and all the other agencies and the bureaucrats and the politics and all that is just a different level. But somebody's actually got to get in there and get the work done. So I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Steve. I enjoyed it.
All right. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. I want to thank Monica Goki, our producer, and Dave Waldron running the controls.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Alaska Pacific University is still accepting applications for the fall 2015 semester for their Master of Business Administration program. APU offers personalized education grounded in hands-on, real-world experiences to prepare graduates to be leaders in their communities. More at 1-800-ALASKA-U or alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.